Sonya began watching her friend still more attentively, and noticed that at dinner and all that evening, Natasha was in a strange and unnatural state. She answered questions at random, began sentences she did not finish, and laughed at everything. After tea, Sonya noticed a housemaid at Natasha's door timidly waiting to let her pass. She let the girl go in, and then, listening at the door, learned that another letter had been delivered. Then suddenly it became clear to Sonya that Natasha had some dreadful plan for that evening. Sonya knocked at her door. Natasha did not let her in. "She will run away with him," thought Sonya. "She is capable of anything." There was something particularly pathetic and resolute in her face today. She cried as she said goodbye to Uncle, Sonya remembered. "Yes, that's it. She means to elope with him." "But what am I to do?" thought she, recalling all the signs that clearly indicated that Natasha had some terrible intention. "The Count is away. What am I to do? Write to Kuragin, demanding an explanation? But what is there to oblige him to reply? Write to Pierre, as Prince Andrew asked me to, in case of some misfortune? But perhaps she really has already refused Bolkonski. She sent a letter to Princess Mary yesterday, and Uncle is away. To tell Marya Dmitrievna, who had such faith in Natasha, seemed to Sonya terrible. Well, anyway, thought Sonya, as she stood in the dark passage, now or never, I must prove that I remember the family's goodness to me, and that I love Nicholas. Yes, if I don't sleep for 3 nights, I'll not leave this passage, and will hold her back by force and not let the family be disgraced, thought she. Chapter 16. Anatole at Dolokhov's. Balaga. Anatole had lately moved to Dolokhov's. The plan for Natalie Rostova's abduction had been arranged and the preparations made by Dolokhov a few days before. And on the day that Sonya, after listening at Natasha's door, resolved to safeguard her, it was to have been put into execution. Natasha had promised to come out to Kuragin at the back porch at 10 that evening. Kuragin was to put her into a troika he would have ready and to drive her 40 miles to the village of Kamyanka, where an unfrocked priest was in readiness to perform a marriage ceremony over them. At Kamyanka, a relay of horses was to wait, which would take them to the Warsaw High Road, and from there they would hasten abroad with post horses. Anatole had a passport, an order for post horses, 10,000 rubles he had taken from his sister, and another 10,000 borrowed with Dolokhov's help. 2 witnesses for the mock marriage, Khvostikov, a retired petty officer whom Dolokhov made use of in his gambling transactions, and Makarin, a retired hussar, a kindly, weak fellow who had an unbounded affection for Kuragin, were sitting at tea in Dolokhov's front room. In his large study, the walls of which were hung to the ceiling with Persian rugs, bearskins, and weapons, sat Dolokhov in a traveling cloak and high boots, at an open desk on which lay an abacus and some bundles of paper money. Anatole, with uniform unbuttoned, walked to and fro from the room where the witnesses were sitting, through the study to the room behind, where his French valet and others were packing the last of his things. Dolokhov was counting the money and noting something down. "Well," he said, "Khvostikov must have 2,000. "Give it to him, then," said Anatole. "Makarka," their name for Makarin, "will go through fire and water for you for nothing, so here are our accounts all settled," said Dolokhov, showing him the memorandum. "Is that right?" "Yes, of course," returned Anatole, evidently not listening to Dolokhov, and looking straight before him with a smile that did not leave his face. Dolokhov banged down the lid of his desk and turned to Anatole with an ironic smile. "You know, you'd really better drop it all. There's still time." "Fool," retorted Anatole, "don't talk nonsense. If you only knew, it's the devil knows what." "No, really, give it up," said Dolokhov. "I'm speaking seriously. It's no joke, this plot you've hatched." "What, teasing again? Go to the devil, eh?" said Anatole, making a grimace. "Really, it's no time for your stupid jokes." And he left the room. Dolokhov smiled contemptuously and condescendingly when Anatole had gone out. "You wait a bit," he called after him. "I'm not joking. I'm talking sense. Come here, come here." Anatole returned and looked at Dolokhov, trying to give him his attention and evidently submitting to him involuntarily. Now listen to me. I'm telling you this for the last time. Why should I joke about it? Did I hinder you? Who arranged everything for you? Who found the priest and got the passport? Who raised the money? I did it all. Well, thank you for it. Do you think I'm not grateful? And Anatole sighed and embraced Dolokhov. I helped you, but all the same, I must tell you the truth. It's a dangerous business, and if you think about it, a stupid business. Well, you'll carry her off. All right. Will they let it stop at that? It will come out that you're already married. Why, they'll have you in the criminal court. Oh, nonsense, nonsense, Anatole ejaculated and again made a grimace. Didn't I explain to you? What? And Anatole, with the partiality dull-witted people have for any conclusion they have reached by their own reasoning, repeated the argument he had already put to Dolokhov 100 times. Didn't I explain to you that I've come to this conclusion? If this marriage is invalid, he went on, crooking one finger, then I have nothing to answer for. But if it is valid, no matter. Abroad, no one will know anything about it. Isn't that so? And don't talk to me. Don't. Seriously, you'd better drop it. You'll only get yourself into a mess. Go to the devil, cried Anatole, and clutching his hair, left the room, but returned at once and dropped into an armchair in front of Dolokhov with his feet tucked under him. It's the very devil, Juan. Feel how it beats. He took Dolokhov's hand and put it on his heart. Oh, what a foot, my dear fellow. What a glance. A goddess, he added in French. What? Dolokhov, with a cold smile and a gleam in his handsome, insolent eyes, looked at him, evidently wishing to get some more amusement out of him. Well, and when the money's gone, what then? What then, eh? Repeated Anatole, sincerely perplexed by a thought of the future. What then? Then, I don't know. But why talk nonsense? He glanced at his watch. It's time. Anatole went into the back room. Now then, nearly ready, you're dawdling, he shouted to the servants. Dolokhov put away the money, called a footman whom he ordered to bring something for them to eat and drink before the journey, and went into the room where Khvostikov and Makarin were sitting. Anatole lay on the sofa in the study, leaning on his elbow and smiling pensively, while his handsome lips muttered tenderly to himself. Come and eat something. Have a drink, Dolokhov shouted to him from the other room. I don't want to, answered Anatole, continuing to smile. Come, Balaga is here. Anatole rose and went into the dining room. Balaga was a famous troika driver who had known Dolokhov and Anatole some 6 years and given them good service with his troikas. More than once, when Anatole's regiment was stationed at Tver, he had taken him from Tver in the evening, brought him to Moscow by daybreak, and driven him back again the next night. More than once, he had enabled Dolokhov to escape when pursued. More than once he had driven them through the town with gypsies and ladykins, as he called the cocottes. More than once in their service he had run over pedestrians and upset vehicles in the streets of Moscow, and had always been protected from the consequences by my gentlemen, as he called them. He had ruined more than one horse in their service. More than once they had beaten him, and more than once they had made him drunk on champagne and Madeira, which he loved, and he knew more than one thing about each of them which would long ago have sent an ordinary man to Siberia. They often called Balaga into their orgies and made him drink and dance at the gypsies, and more than 1,000 rubles of their money had passed through his hands. In their service, he risked his skin and his life 20 times a year, and in their service had lost more horses than the money he had from them would buy. But he liked them, liked that mad driving at 12 miles an hour, liked upsetting a driver or running down a pedestrian and flying at full gallop through the Moscow streets. He liked to hear those wild, tipsy shouts behind him, "Get on! Get on!" when it was impossible to go any faster. He liked giving a painful lash on the neck to some peasant who, more dead than alive, was already hurrying out of his way. Real gentlemen, he considered them. Anatole and Dolokhov liked Balaga, too, for his masterly driving and because he liked the things they liked. With others, Balaga bargained, charging 25 rubles for a 2 hours' drive, and rarely drove himself, generally letting his young men do so. But with his gentlemen, he always drove himself and never demanded anything for his work. Only a couple of times a year, when he knew from their valets that they had money in hand, he would turn up of a morning quite sober, and with a deep bow would ask them to help him. The gentleman always made him sit down. "Do help me out, Fyodor Ivanitch, sir, or Your Excellency," he would say. "I'm quite out of horses. Let me have what you can to go to the fair." And Anatole and Dolokhov, when they had money, would give him 1,000 or a couple of 1,000 rubles. Balaga was a fair-haired, short, and snub-nosed peasant of about 27, red-faced, with a particularly red, thick neck, glittering little eyes, and a small beard. He wore a fine, dark blue, silk-lined cloth coat over a sheepskin. On entering the room now, he crossed himself, turning toward the front corner of the room, and went up to Dolokhov, holding out a small black hand. "Fyodor Ivanitch," he said, bowing. "How do you do, friend?" "Well, here he is." "Good day, Your Excellency," he said, again holding out his hand to Anatole, who had just come in. "I say, Balaga," said Anatole, putting his hands on the man's shoulders, "do you care for me or not, eh? Now, do me a service. What horses have you come with, eh?"
"As your messenger ordered, your special beasts," replied Balaga.
"Well, listen, Balaga. Drive all three to death, but get me there in 3 hours, eh?"
"When they are dead, what shall I drive?" said Balaga with a wink.
"Mind, I'll smash your face in. Don't make jokes," cried Anatole, suddenly rolling his eyes.
"Why joke?" said the driver, laughing. "As if I'd grudge my gentleman anything. As fast as ever the horses can gallop, so fast we'll go."
"Ah," said Anatole. "Well, sit down."
"Yes, sit down," said Dolokhov. "I'll stand, Fyodor Ivanitch."
"Sit down, nonsense. Have a drink," said Anatole, and filled a large glass of Madeira for him. The driver's eyes sparkled at the sight of the wine. After refusing it for manner's sake, he drank it and wiped his mouth with a red silk handkerchief he took out of his cap.
"And when are we to start, Your Excellency?"
"Well," Anatole looked at his watch. "We'll start at once. Mind, Balaga, you'll get there in time, eh?"
"That depends on our luck in starting, else why shouldn't we be there in time?" replied Balaga. "Didn't we get you to Tver in 7 hours? I think you remember that, Your Excellency."
"Do you know, one Christmas I drove from Tver," said Anatole, smiling at the recollection and turning to Makarin, who gazed rapturously at him with wide-open eyes. "Will you believe it, Makarka? It took one's breath away, the rate we flew. We came across a train of loaded sleighs and drove right over two of them, eh?"
"Those were horses," Balaga continued the tale. "That time I'd harnessed 2 young side horses with the bay and the shafts," he went on, turning to Dolokhov. "Will you believe it, Fyodor Ivanitch? Those animals flew 40 miles. I couldn't hold them in. My hands grew numb in the sharp frost, so that I threw down the reins. 'Catch hold yourself, Your Excellency,' says I, and I just tumbled on the bottom of the sleigh and sprawled there. It wasn't a case of urging them on. There was no holding them in till we reached the place. The devils took us there in 3 hours. Only the near one died of it."
Chapter 17. Anatole sets off to abduct Natasha, but encounters Marya Dmitrievna's footman. Anatole went out of the room and returned a few minutes later, wearing a fur coat girt with a silver belt and a sable cap jauntily set on one side and very becoming to his handsome face. Having looked in a mirror, and standing before Dolokhov in the same pose he had assumed before it, he lifted a glass of wine. "Well, goodbye, Theodor. Thank you for everything, and farewell," said Anatole. "Well, comrades and friends," he considered for a moment, "of my youth, farewell," he said, turning to Makarin and the others. Though they were all going with him, Anatole evidently wished to make something touching and solemn out of this address to his comrades. He spoke slowly in a loud voice, and throwing his chest out, slightly swayed one leg. "All take glasses. You too, Balaga. Well, comrades and friends of my youth, we've had our fling and lived and reveled, eh? And now, when shall we meet again? I'm going abroad. We've had a good time. Now, farewell, lads. To our health. Hurrah!" he cried, and emptying his glass, flung it on the floor. "To your health," said Balaga, who also emptied his glass and wiped his mouth with his handkerchief. Makarin embraced Anatole with tears in his eyes.
"Oh, Prince, how sorry I am to part from you. Let's go, let's go, cried Anatole. Balaga was about to leave the room. No, stop, said Anatole. Shut the door. We have first to sit down. That's the way. They shut the door and all sat down. Note, this is in accord with the Russian superstition as to what should be done when starting on a journey. Now, quick march, lads, said Anatole, rising. Joseph, his valet, handed him his sabre-tash and sabre, and they all went out into the vestibule. And where's the fur cloak? Asked Dolokhov. Hey, Ignatka, go to Matryona Matryevna and ask her for the sable cloak. I've heard what elopements are like, continued Dolokhov with a wink. Why, she'll rush out more dead than alive just in the thing she's wearing. If you delay at all, there'll be tears, and Papa and Mama, and she's frozen in a minute, must go back. But you wrap the fur cloak round her first thing and carry her to the sleigh. The valet brought a woman's fox-lined cloak. Fool, I told you the sable one. Hey, Matryona, the sable! He shouted so that his voice rang far through the rooms. A handsome, slim, and pale-faced gypsy girl with glittering black eyes and curly blue-black hair, wearing a red shawl, ran out with a sable mantle on her arm. Here, I don't grudge it, take it, she said, evidently afraid of her master and yet regretful of her cloak. Dolokhov, without answering, took the cloak, threw it over Matryona, and wrapped her up in it. That's the way, said Dolokhov, and then so. And he turned the collar up round her head, leaving only a little of the face uncovered. And then so, do you see? And he pushed Anatole's head forward to meet the gap left by the collar through which Matryona's brilliant smile was seen. Well, goodbye, Matryona, said Anatole, kissing her. Ah, my revels here are over. Remember me to Stoshka. There, goodbye. Goodbye, Matryona. Wish me luck. Well, Prince, may God give you great luck, said Matryona in her gypsy accent. Two troikas were standing before the porch, and two young drivers were holding the horses. Balagat took his seat in the front one, and holding his elbows high, arranged the reins deliberately. Anatole and Dolokhov got in with him. Makarin, Khvostikov, and a valet seated themselves in the other sleigh. Well, are you ready? Asked Balaga. Go, he cried, twisting the reins round his hands, and the troika tore down the Nikitsky Boulevard. T-pruh! Get out of the way! Hi! T-pruh! The shouting of Balaga and of the sturdy young fellow seated on the box was all that could be heard. On the Arbat Square, the troika caught against a carriage. Something cracked, shouts were heard, and the troika flew along the Arbat Street. After taking a turn along the Podnovinsky Boulevard, Balaga began to rein in, and turning back, drew up at the crossing of the old Konyushiny Street. The young fellow on the box jumped down to hold the horses, and Anatole and Dolokhov went along the pavement. When they reached the gate, Dolokhov whistled. The whistle was answered, and a maidservant ran out. Come into the courtyard or you'll be seen. She'll come out directly, said she. Dolokhov stayed at the gate. Anatole followed the maid into the courtyard, turned the corner, and ran up into the porch. He was met by Gabriel, Marya Dmitrievna's gigantic footman.
Come to the mistress, please, said the footman in his deep bass, intercepting any retreat.
To what mistress? Who are you?
Asked Anatole in a breathless whisper.
Kindly step in. My orders are to bring you in.
Kuragin, come back, shouted Dolokhov. Betrayed, back!
Dolokhov, after Anatole entered, had remained at the wicket gate and was struggling with the yard porter who was trying to lock it. With a last desperate effort, Dolokhov pushed the porter aside, and when Anatole ran back, seized him by the arm, pulled him through the wicket, and ran back with him to the troika. Chapter 18. Marya Dmitrievna reproaches Natasha. Count Ilya Rostov is kept in ignorance. Marya Dmitrievna, having found Sonya weeping in the corridor, made her confess everything, and intercepting the note to Natasha, she read it and went to Natasha's room with it in her hand.
You shameless good-for-nothing, said she. I won't hear a word.
Pushing back Natasha, who looked at her with astonished but tearless eyes, she locked her in, and having given orders to the yard porter to admit the persons who would be coming that evening, but not to let them out again, and having told the footman to bring them up to her, she seated herself in the drawing-room to await the abductors. When Gabriel came to inform her that the men who had come had run away again, she rose frowning, and, clasping her hands behind her, paced through the rooms a long time, considering what she should do. Toward midnight, she went to Natasha's room, fingering the key in her pocket. Sonya was sitting sobbing in the corridor.
Marya Dmitrievna, for God's sake, let me in to her, she pleaded.
But Marya Dmitrievna unlocked the door and went in without giving her an answer.
Disgusting. Abominable. In my house. Horrid girl. Hussy. I'm only sorry for her father, thought she, trying to restrain her wrath. Hard as it may be, I'll tell them all to hold their tongues and we'll hide it from the Count.
She entered the room with resolute steps. Natasha was lying on the sofa, her head hidden in her hands, and she did not stir. She was in just the same position in which Marya Dmitrievna had left her.
A nice girl. Very nice, said Marya Dmitrievna. Arranging meetings with lovers in my house. It's no use pretending. You listen when I speak to you.
And Marya Dmitrievna touched her arm.
Listen when I speak. You've disgraced yourself like the lowest of hussies. I treat you differently, but I'm sorry for your father, so I will conceal it.
Natasha did not change her position, but her whole body heaved with noiseless, convulsive sobs which choked her. Marya Dmitrievna glanced round at Sonya and seated herself on the sofa beside Natasha.
It's lucky for him that he escaped me. But I'll find him, she said in her rough voice. Do you hear what I'm saying or not? She added.
She put her large hand on Natasha's face and turned it toward her. Both Marya Dmitrievna and Sonya were amazed when they saw how Natasha looked. Her eyes were dry and glistening, her lips compressed, her cheeks sunken.
Let me be. What is it to me? I shall die, she muttered, wrenching herself from Marya Dmitrievna's hands with a vicious effort and sinking down again into her former position.
Natalie, said Marya Dmitrievna, I wish for your good. Lie still, stay like that, then I won't touch you. But listen, I won't tell you how guilty you are. You know that yourself. But when your father comes back tomorrow, what am I to tell him, huh?
Again Natasha's body shook with sobs.
Suppose he finds out, and your brother, and your betrothed.
I have no betrothed. I've refused him, cried Natasha.
That's all the same, continued Marya Dmitrievna. If they hear of this, will they let it pass? He, your father, I know him. If he challenges him to a duel, would that be all right, eh?
Oh, let me be. Why have you interfered at all? Why? Who asked you to?
Shouted Natasha, raising herself on the sofa and looking malignantly at Marya Dmitrievna.
But what did you want? Cried Marya Dmitrievna, growing angry again. Were you kept under lock and key? Who hindered his coming to the house? Why carry you off as if you were some gypsy singing girl? Well, if he had carried you off, do you think they wouldn't have found him? Your father or brother or your betrothed? And he's a scoundrel, a wretch, that's a fact.
He's better than any of you, exclaimed Natasha, getting up. If you hadn't interfered... Oh, my God, what is it all? What is it, Sonya? Why, go away!
And she burst into sobs with the despairing vehemence with which people bewail disasters they feel they have themselves occasioned. Marya Dmitrievna was about to speak again, but Natasha cried out,
go away, you all hate and despise me.
And she threw herself back on the sofa. Marya Dmitrievna went on admonishing her for some time, enjoining on her that it must all be kept from her father, and assuring her that nobody would know anything about it if only Natasha herself would undertake to forget it all and not let anyone see that something had happened. Natasha did not reply, nor did she sob any longer. But she grew cold and had a shivering fit. Marya Dmitrievna put a pillow under her head, covered her with two quilts, and herself brought her some lime flower water. But Natasha did not respond to her. Well, let her sleep, said Marya Dmitrievna, as she went out of the room, supposing Natasha to be asleep. But Natasha was not asleep. With pale face and fixed wide-open eyes, she looked straight before her. All that night she did not sleep or weep, and did not speak to Sonya, who got up and went to her several times. Next day, Count Rostov returned from his estate near Moscow in time for lunch, as he had promised. He was in very good spirits. The affair with the purchaser was going on satisfactorily, and there was nothing to keep him any longer in Moscow, away from the Countess, whom he missed. Marya Dmitrievna met him and told him that Natasha had been very unwell the day before, and that they had sent for the doctor, but that she was better now. Natasha had not left her room that morning. With compressed and parched lips and dry, fixed eyes, she sat at the window, uneasily watching the people who drove past, and hurriedly glancing round at anyone who entered the room. She was evidently expecting news of him, and that he would come or would write to her.
When the Count came to see her, she turned anxiously round at the sound of a man's footstep, and then her face resumed its cold and malevolent expression. She did not even get up to greet him.
"What is the matter with you, my angel? Are you ill?" asked the Count.
After a moment's silence, Natasha answered, "Yes, ill." In reply to the Count's anxious inquiries as to why she was so dejected, and whether anything had happened to her betrothed, she assured him that nothing had happened, and asked him not to worry. Marya Dmitrievna confirmed Natasha's assurances that nothing had happened. From the pretense of illness, from his daughter's distress, and by the embarrassed faces of Sonya and Marya Dmitrievna, the Count saw clearly that something had gone wrong during his absence. But it was so terrible for him to think that anything disgraceful had happened to his beloved daughter, and he so prized his own cheerful tranquillity, that he avoided inquiries and tried to assure himself that nothing particularly had happened, and he was only dissatisfied that her indisposition delayed their return to the country. Chapter 19. Pierre at Marya Dmitrievna's. He tells Natasha that Anatole is married. From the day his wife arrived in Moscow, Pierre had been intending to go away somewhere so as not to be near her. Soon after the Rostovs came to Moscow, the effect Natasha had on him made him hasten to carry out his intention. He went to Tver to see Joseph Alexeyevich's widow, who had long since promised to hand over to him some papers of her deceased husband's. When he returned to Moscow, Pierre was handed a letter from Marya Dmitrievna asking him to come and see her on a matter of great importance relating to Andrew Bolkonsky and his betrothed. Pierre had been avoiding Natasha because it seemed to him that his feeling for her was stronger than a married man should be for his friend's fiancée. Yet some fate constantly threw them together. "What can have happened? And what can they want with me?" thought he as he dressed to go to Marya Dmitrievna's. "If only Prince Andrew would hurry up and come and marry her," thought he on his way to the house. On the Tverskoy Boulevard, a familiar voice called to him.
"Pierre! Been back long?"
someone shouted. Pierre raised his head. In a sleigh drawn by two gray trotting horses that were bespattering the dashboard with snow, Anatole and his constant companion Makarin dashed past. Anatole was sitting upright in the classic pose of military dandies, the lower part of his face hidden by his beaver collar and his head slightly bent. His face was fresh and rosy. His white-plumed hat, tilted to one side, disclosed his curled and pomaded hair, besprinkled with powdery snow. "Yes, indeed, that's a true sage," thought Pierre. "He sees nothing beyond the pleasure of the moment. Nothing troubles him, and so he's always cheerful, satisfied, and serene. What wouldn't I give to be like him?" he thought enviously. In Marya Dmitrievna's anteroom, the footman who helped him off with his fur coat said that the mistress asked him to come to her bedroom. When he opened the ballroom door, Pierre saw Natasha sitting at the window with a thin, pale, and spiteful face. She glanced round at him, frowned, and left the room with an expression of cold dignity. "What has happened?" asked Pierre, entering Marya Dmitrievna's room. "Fine doings," answered Marya Dmitrievna. "For 58 years have I lived in this world and never known anything so disgraceful." And having put him on his honor not to repeat anything she told him, Marya Dmitrievna informed him that Natasha had refused Prince Andrew without her parents' knowledge, and that the cause of this was Anatole Kuragin, into whose society Pierre's wife had thrown her, and with whom Natasha had tried to elope during her father's absence in order to be married secretly. Pierre raised his shoulders and listened open-mouthed to what was told him, scarcely able to believe his own ears. That Prince Andrew's deeply loved, affianced wife, the same Natasha Rostova who used to be so charming, should give up Bolkonsky for that fool Anatole who was already secretly married, as Pierre knew, and should be so in love with him as to agree to run away with him, was something Pierre could not conceive and could not imagine. He could not reconcile the charming impression he had of Natasha, whom he had known from a child, with this new conception of her baseness, folly, and cruelty. He thought of his wife. "They are all alike," he said to himself, reflecting that he was not the only man unfortunate enough to be tied to a bad woman. But still he pitied Prince Andrew to the point of tears, and sympathized with his wounded pride. And the more he pitied his friend, the more did he think with contempt and even with disgust of that Natasha who had just passed him in the ballroom with such a look of cold dignity. He did not know that Natasha's soul was overflowing with despair, shame, and humiliation, and that it was not her fault that her face happened to assume an expression of calm dignity and severity.
"But how get married?" said Pierre, in answer to Marya Dmitrievna. "He could not marry. He is married."
"Things get worse from hour to hour," ejaculated Marya Dmitrievna. "A nice youth, what a scoundrel! And she's expecting him since yesterday. She must be told, then at least she won't go on expecting him."
After hearing the details of Anatole's marriage from Pierre, and giving vent to her anger against Anatole in words of abuse, Marya Dmitrievna told Pierre why she had sent for him. She was afraid that the Count or Bolkonski, who might arrive at any moment, if they knew of this affair, which she hoped to hide from them, might challenge Anatole to a duel, and she therefore asked Pierre to tell his brother-in-law in her name to leave Moscow and not dare to let her set eyes on him again. Pierre, only now realizing the danger to the old Count, Nicholas, and Prince Andrew, promised to do as she wished. Having briefly and exactly explained her wishes to him, she let him go to the drawing-room. "Mind, the Count knows nothing. Behave as if you know nothing either," she said. "And I will go and tell her it is no use expecting him. And stay to dinner if you care to," she called after Pierre. Pierre met the old Count, who seemed nervous and upset. That morning, Natasha had told him that she had rejected Bolkonski.
"Oh, troubles, troubles, my dear fellow," he said to Pierre. "What troubles one has with these girls without their mother. I do so regret having come here. I will be frank with you. Have you heard she's broken off her engagement without consulting anybody? It's true this engagement never was much to my liking. Of course, he's an excellent man, but still, with his father's disapproval, they wouldn't have been happy, and Natasha won't lack suitors. Still, it has been going on so long, and to take such a step without father's or mother's consent. And now she's ill, and God knows what. It's hard, Count, hard to manage daughters in their mother's absence."
Pierre saw that the Count was much upset and tried to change the subject, but the Count returned to his troubles. Sonia entered the room with an agitated face. "Natasha is not quite well. She's in her room and would like to see you. Marya Dmitrievna is with her, and she too asks you to come."
"Yes, you're a great friend of Bolkonski's. No doubt she wants to send him a message," said the Count. Oh, dear, how happy it all was."
And clutching the spare gray locks on his temples, the Count left the room. When Marya Dmitrievna told Natasha that Anatole was married, Natasha did not wish to believe it and insisted on having it confirmed by Pierre himself. Sonia told Pierre this as she led him along the corridor to Natasha's room. Natasha, pale and stern, was sitting beside Marya Dmitrievna, and her eyes, glittering feverishly, met Pierre with a questioning look the moment he entered. She did not smile or nod, but only gazed fixedly at him, and her look asked only one thing. Was he a friend, or, like the others, an enemy in regard to Anatole? As for Pierre, he evidently did not exist for her. "He knows all about it," said Marya Dmitrievna, pointing to Pierre and addressing Natasha. "Let him tell you whether I've told the truth." Natasha looked from one to the other as a hunted and wounded animal looks at the approaching dogs and sportsmen. "Natalia Ilyinichna," Pierre began, dropping his eyes with a feeling of pity for her and loathing for the thing he had to do. "Whether it is true or not should make no difference to you, because..."
"Then it is not true that he's married?"
"Yes, it is true."
"Has he been married long?" she asked. "On your honor?"
Pierre gave his word of honor.
"Is he still here?" she asked quickly.
"Yes, I've just seen him."
She was evidently unable to speak and made a sign with her hands that they should leave her alone. Chapter 20. Pierre's Explanation with Anatole. Pierre did not stay for dinner, but left the room and went away at once. He drove through the town seeking Anatole Kuragin, at the thought of whom now the blood rushed to his heart and he felt a difficulty in breathing. He was not at the Ice Hills, nor at the Gypsies, nor at Komonino's. Pierre drove to the club. In the club, all was going on as usual. The members who were assembling for dinner were sitting about in groups. They greeted Pierre and spoke of the town news. The footman, having greeted him, knowing his habits and his acquaintances, told him there was a place left for him in the small dining room, and that Prince Michael Zakharych was in the library, but Paul Timofeyevich had not yet arrived. One of Pierre's acquaintances, while they were talking about the weather, asked if he had heard of Kuragin's abduction of Rostova, which was talked of in the town, and was it true? Pierre laughed and said it was nonsense, for he had just come from the Rostovs. He asked everyone about Anatole. One man told him he had not come yet, and another that he was coming to dinner. Pierre felt it strange to see this calm, indifferent crowd of people unaware of what was going on in his soul. He paced through the ballroom, waited till everyone had come, and as Anatole had not turned up, did not stay for dinner, but drove home. Anatole, for whom Pierre was looking, dined that day with Dolokhov, consulting him as to how to remedy this unfortunate affair. It seemed to him essential to see Natasha. In the evening, he drove to his sister's to discuss with her how to arrange a meeting. When Pierre returned home after vainly hunting all over Moscow, his valet informed him that Prince Anatole was with the Countess. The Countess's drawing room was full of guests. Pierre, without greeting his wife, whom he had not seen since his return, at that moment she was more repulsive to him than ever, entered the drawing room and, seeing Anatole, went up to him. "Ah, Pierre," said the Countess, going up to her husband, "you don't know what a plight our Anatole—" She stopped, seeing in the forward thrust of her husband's head, in his glowing eyes and his resolute gait, the terrible indications of that rage and strength which she knew and had herself experienced after his duel with Dolokhov. "Where you are, there is vice and evil," said Pierre to his wife. "Anatole, come with me. I must speak to you," he added in French. Anatole glanced round at his sister and rose submissively, ready to follow Pierre. Pierre, taking him by the arm, pulled him toward himself and was leading him from the room. "If you allow yourself in my drawing room," whispered Hélène, but Pierre did not reply and went out of the room. Anatole followed him with his usual jaunty step, but his face betrayed anxiety. Having entered his study, Pierre closed the door and addressed Anatole without looking at him. "You promised Countess Rostova to marry her and were about to elope with her. Is that so?" "Mon cher," answered Anatole. Their whole conversation was in French. "I don't consider myself bound to answer questions put to me in that tone." Pierre's face, already pale, became distorted by fury. He seized Anatole by the collar of his uniform with his big hand and shook him from side to side till Anatole's face showed a sufficient degree of terror. "When I tell you that I must talk to you," repeated Pierre. "Come now, this is stupid. What?" said Anatole, fingering a button of his collar that had been wrenched loose with a bit of the cloth. "You're a scoundrel and a blackguard, and I don't know what deprives me from the pleasure of smashing your head with this," said Pierre, expressing himself so artificially because he was talking French. He took a heavy paperweight and lifted it threateningly, but at once put it back in its place. "Did you promise to marry her?" I didn't think of it. I never promised because—" Pierre interrupted him. "Have you any letters of hers?" "Any letters?" he said, moving toward Anatole. Anatole glanced at him and immediately thrust his hand into his pocket and drew out his pocketbook. Pierre took the letter Anatole handed him and, pushing aside a table that stood in his way, threw himself on the sofa. "I shan't be violent, don't be afraid," said Pierre, in answer to a frightened gesture of Anatole's. "First, the letters," said he, as if repeating a lesson to himself. "Secondly," he continued after a short pause, again rising and again pacing the room, "tomorrow you must get out of Moscow."
"But how can I—"
"Thirdly," Pierre continued without listening to him, "you must never breathe a word of what has passed between you and Countess Rostova. I know I can't prevent your doing so, but if you have a spark of conscience—" Pierre paced the room several times in silence. Anatole sat at a table, frowning and biting his lips. "After all, you must understand that besides your pleasure, there is such a thing as other people's happiness and peace, and that you're ruining a whole life for the sake of amusing yourself. Amuse yourself with women like my wife. With them you are within your rights, for they know what you want of them. They're armed against you by the same experience of debauchery.
promise a maid to marry her. To deceive, to kidnap. Don't you understand that it is as mean as beating an old man or a child?
Pierre paused and looked at Anatole no longer with an angry but with a questioning look.
I don't know about that, eh?
Said Anatole, growing more confident as Pierre mastered his wrath. I don't know that and don't want to, he said, not looking at Pierre and with a slight tremor of his lower jaw.
But you've used such words to me, mean and so on, which as a man of honor I can't allow anyone to use.
Pierre glanced at him with amazement, unable to understand what he wanted.
Though it was tête-à-tête, Anatole continued, still I can't... Is it satisfaction you want?
Said Pierre ironically. You could at least take back your words, what? If you want me to do as you wish, eh?
I take them back, I take them back, said Pierre. And I ask you to forgive me.
Pierre involuntarily glanced at the loose button.
And if you require money for your journey...
Anatole smiled. The expression of that base and cringing smile which Pierre knew so well in his wife revolted him.
Oh, vile and heartless brood, he exclaimed, and left the room.
Next day, Anatole left for Petersburg. Chapter 21. Natasha tries to poison herself. Prince Andrew returns to Moscow, and Pierre talks to him. Pierre drove to Maria Dmitrievna's to tell her of the fulfillment of her wish that Kuragin should be banished from Moscow. The whole house was in a state of alarm and commotion. Natasha was very ill, having, as Maria Dmitrievna told him in secret, poisoned herself the night after she had been told that Anatole was married with some arsenic she had stealthily procured. After swallowing a little, she had been so frightened that she woke Sonia and told her what she had done. The necessary antidotes had been administered in time, and she was now out of danger, though still so weak that it was out of the question to move her to the country. And so the Countess had been sent for. Pierre saw the distracted Count and Sonia, who had a tear-stained face, but he could not see Natasha. Pierre dined at the club that day and heard on all sides gossip about the attempted abduction of Rostova. He resolutely denied these rumors, assuring everyone that nothing had happened except that his brother-in-law had proposed to her and been refused. It seemed to Pierre that it was his duty to conceal the whole affair and re-establish Natasha's reputation. He was awaiting Prince Andrew's return with dread and went every day to the old prince's for news of him. Old Prince Bolkonski heard all the rumors current in the town from Mademoiselle Bourienne and had read the note to Princess Mary in which Natasha had broken off her engagement. He seemed in better spirits than usual and awaited his son with great impatience. Some days after Anatole's departure, Pierre received a note from Prince Andrew informing him of his arrival and asking him to come to see him. As soon as he reached Moscow, Prince Andrew had received from his father Natasha's note to Princess Mary breaking off her engagement. Mademoiselle Bourienne had purloined it from Princess Mary and given it to the old prince. And he heard from him the story of Natasha's elopement, with additions. Prince Andrew had arrived in the evening, and Pierre came to see him next morning. Pierre expected to find Prince Andrew in almost the same state as Natasha, and was therefore surprised, on entering the drawing room, to hear him in the study, talking in a loud, animated voice about some intrigue going on in Petersburg. The old prince's voice and another now and then interrupted him. Princess Mary came out to meet Pierre. She sighed, looking toward the door of the room where Prince Andrew was, evidently intending to express her sympathy with his sorrow, but Pierre saw by her face that she was glad both at what had happened and at the way her brother had taken the news of Natasha's faithlessness. He says he expected it, she remarked. I know his pride will not let him express his feelings, but still he has taken it better, far better than I expected. Evidently it had to be. But is it possible that all is really ended? Asked Pierre. Princess Mary looked at him with astonishment. She did not understand how he could ask such a question. Pierre went into the study. Prince Andrew, greatly changed and plainly in better health, but with a fresh horizontal wrinkle between his brows, stood in civilian dress facing his father and Prince Mischersky, warmly disputing and vigorously gesticulating. The conversation was about Speransky, the news of whose sudden exile and alleged treachery had just reached Moscow. "Now he is censured and accused by all who were enthusiastic about him a month ago," Prince Andrew was saying, "and by those who were unable to understand his aims. To judge a man who is in disfavor and to throw on him all the blame of other men's mistakes is very easy. But I maintain that if anything good has been accomplished in this reign, it was done by him alone." He paused at the sight of Pierre. His face quivered and immediately assumed a vindictive expression. "Posterity will do him justice," he concluded, and at once turned to Pierre. "Well, how are you? Still getting stouter?" he said with animation, but the new wrinkle on his forehead deepened. "Yes, I'm well," he said in answer to Pierre's question, and smiled. To Pierre, that smile said plainly, "I'm well, but my health is now of no use to anyone." After a few words to Pierre about the awful roads from the Polish frontier, about people he had met in Switzerland who knew Pierre, and about Monsieur de Sales, whom he had brought from abroad to be his son's tutor, Prince Andrew again joined warmly in the conversation about Speransky, which was still going on between the two old men. "If there were treason or proofs of secret relations with Napoleon, they would have been made public," he said with warmth and haste. "I do not and never did like Speransky personally, but I like justice." Pierre now recognized in his friend a need with which he was only too familiar, to get excited and to have arguments about extraneous matters in order to stifle thoughts that were too oppressive and too intimate. When Prince Myszczerski had left, Prince Andrew took Pierre's arm and asked him into the room that had been assigned to him. A bed had been made up there, and some open portmanteaus and trunks stood about. Prince Andrew went to one and took out a small casket, from which he drew a packet wrapped in paper. He did it all silently and very quickly. He stood up and coughed. His face was gloomy and his lips compressed. "Forgive me for troubling you." Pierre saw that Prince Andrew was going to speak of Natasha, and his broad face expressed pity and sympathy. This expression irritated Prince Andrew, and in a determined, ringing, and unpleasant tone, he continued, "I have received a refusal from Countess Rostova, and have heard reports of your brother-in-law having sought her hand or something of that kind. Is that true?" "Both true and untrue," Pierre began, but Prince Andrew interrupted him. "Here are her letters and her portrait," said he. He took the packet from the table and handed it to Pierre. "Give this to the Countess, if you see her." "She's very ill," said Pierre. "Then she's here still?" said Prince Andrew. "And Prince Kuragin?" he added quickly. "He left long ago. She's been at death's door." "I much regret her illness," said Prince Andrew, and he smiled like his father, coldly, maliciously, and unpleasantly. "So Monsieur Kuragin has not honored Countess Rostova with his hand?" said Prince Andrew, and he snorted several times. "He could not marry, for he was married already," said Pierre. Prince Andrew laughed disagreeably, again reminding one of his father. "And where is your brother-in-law now, if I may ask?" he said. "He's gone to Peter... but I don't know," said Pierre. "Well, it doesn't matter," said Prince Andrew. "Tell Countess Rostova that she was and is perfectly free and that I wish her all that is good." Pierre took the packet. Prince Andrew, as if trying to remember whether he had something more to say, or waiting to see if Pierre would say anything, looked fixedly at him. "I say, do you remember our discussion in Petersburg?" asked Pierre. "About..." "Yes," returned Prince Andrew hastily. "I said that a fallen woman should be forgiven, but I didn't say I could forgive her. I can't." "Can this be compared?" said Pierre. Prince Andrew interrupted him and cried sharply, "Yes! Ask her hand again, be magnanimous, and so on. Yes, that would be very noble. But I am unable to follow in that gentleman's footsteps. If you wish to be my friend, never speak to me of that... of all that. Well, goodbye. So you'll give her the packet?" Pierre left the room and went to the old prince and Princess Mary. The old man seemed livelier than usual. Princess Mary was the same as always, but beneath her sympathy for her brother, Pierre noticed her satisfaction that the engagement had been broken off. Looking at them, Pierre realized what contempt and animosity they all felt for the Rostovs, and that it was impossible in their presence even to mention the name of her who could give up Prince Andrew for anyone else. At dinner, the talk turned on the war, the approach of which was becoming evident. Prince Andrew talked incessantly, arguing now with his father, now with the Swiss tutor de Sales, and showing an unnatural animation, the cause of which Pierre so well understood. Chapter 22. Pierre and Natasha. He tells her of his devotion. The great comet of 1812. That same evening, Pierre went to the Rostovs to fulfill the commission entrusted to him. Natasha was in bed, the count at the club, and Pierre, after giving the letters to Sonia, went to Marya Dmitrievna, who was interested to know how Prince Andrew had taken the news. 10 minutes later, Sonia came to Marya Dmitrievna. "Natasha insists on seeing Count Peter Kirillovich," said she.
"But how are we to take him up to her? The room there has not been tidied up."
"No, she's dressed and gone into the drawing room," said Sonia. Marya Dmitrievna only shrugged her shoulders.
"When will her mother come? She has worried me to death. Now mind, don't tell her everything," said she to Pierre. "One hasn't the heart to scold her. She's so much to be pitied, so much to be pitied."
Natasha was standing in the middle of the drawing room, emaciated, with a pale, set face, but not at all shamefaced, as Pierre expected to find her. When he appeared at the door, she grew flurried, evidently undecided whether to go to meet him or to wait till he came up. Pierre hastened to her. He thought she would give him her hand as usual, but she, stepping up to him, stopped, breathing heavily, her arms hanging lifelessly just in the pose she used to stand in when she went to the middle of the ballroom to sing, but with quite a different expression of face. "Peter Kirillovich," she began rapidly, "Prince Bolkonski was your friend. Is your friend," she corrected herself. It seemed to her that everything that had once been must now be different. "He told me once to apply to you." Pierre sniffed as he looked at her, but did not speak. Till then he had reproached her in his heart and tried to despise her, but he now felt so sorry for her that there was no room in his soul for reproach. "He is here now. Tell him to forgive me." She stopped and breathed still more quickly, but did not shed tears. "Yes, I will tell him," answered Pierre, but he did not know what to say. Natasha was evidently dismayed at the thought of what he might think she had meant. "No, I know it is all over," she said hurriedly. "No, that can never be. I'm only tormented by the wrong I've done him. Tell him only that I beg him to forgive me for everything." She trembled all over and sat down on a chair. A sense of pity he had never before known overflowed Pierre's heart.
"I will tell him. I will tell him everything once more," said Pierre. "But I should like to know one thing."
"Know what?" Natasha's eyes asked.
"I should like to know, did you love..."
Pierre did not know how to refer to Anatole and flushed at the thought of him.
"Did you love that bad man?"
"Don't call him bad," said Natasha. "But I don't know at all." She began to cry, and a still greater sense of pity, tenderness, and love welled up in Pierre. He felt the tears trickle under his spectacles and hoped they would not be noticed. "We won't speak of it any more, my dear," said Pierre, and his gentle, cordial tone suddenly seemed very strange to Natasha. "We won't speak of it, my dear. I'll tell him everything. But one thing I beg of you. Consider me your friend, and if you want help, advice, or simply to open your heart to someone, not now, but when your mind is clearer, think of me." He took her hand and kissed it. "I shall be happy if it's in my power." Pierre grew confused.
"Don't speak to me like that. I'm not worth it," exclaimed Natasha, and turned to leave the room, but Pierre held her hand.
He knew he had something more to say to her, but when he said it, he was amazed at his own words.
"Stop, stop. You have your whole life before you," said he to her.
"Before me? No. All is over for me," she replied with shame and self-abasement.
"All over," he repeated.
"If I were not myself, but
the handsomest, cleverest, and best man in the world, and were free, I would this moment ask on my knees for your hand and your love.
For the first time for many days, Natasha wept tears of gratitude and tenderness, and glancing at Pierre, she went out of the room. Pierre, too, when she had gone, almost ran into the anteroom, restraining tears of tenderness and joy that choked him, and without finding the sleeves of his fur cloak, threw it on and got into his sleigh.
"Where to now, Your Excellency?" asked the coachman.
"Where to?" Pierre asked himself. "Where can I go now? Surely not to the club or to pay calls." All men seemed so pitiful, so poor, in comparison with this feeling of tenderness and love he experienced, in comparison with that softened, grateful last look she had given him through her tears.
"Home," said Pierre, and despite 22 degrees of frost Fahrenheit, he threw open the bearskin cloak from his broad chest and inhaled the air with joy. It was clear and frosty. Above the dirty, ill-lit streets, above the black roofs, stretched the dark, starry sky. Only looking up at the sky did Pierre cease to feel how sordid and humiliating were all mundane things compared with the heights to which his soul had just been raised. At the entrance to the Arbat Square, an immense expanse of dark, starry sky presented itself to his eyes. Almost in the center of it, above the Prechistienka Boulevard, surrounded and sprinkled on all sides by stars, but distinguished from them all by its nearness to the earth, its white light and its long uplifted tail, shone the enormous and brilliant comet of 1812, the comet which was said to portend all kinds of woes and the end of the world. In Pierre, however, that comet, with its long luminous tail, aroused no feeling of fear. On the contrary, he gazed joyfully, his eyes moist with tears, at this bright comet, which, having traveled in its orbit with inconceivable velocity through immeasurable space, seemed suddenly, like an arrow piercing the earth, to remain fixed in a chosen spot, vigorously holding its tail erect, shining and displaying its white light amid countless other scintillating stars. It seemed to Pierre that this comet fully responded to what was passing in his own softened and uplifted soul, now blossoming into a new life. Book 9. Dates of Principal Historical Events. 1812. Dates are old style. May 17th, Napoleon leaves Dresden. June 12th, Napoleon crosses the Niemen and enters Russia. June 14th, Alexander sends Balashov to Napoleon. July 13th, the Pavlograd Hussars in action at Ostrovna. Chapter 1. The year 1812. Rulers and generals are history's slaves. From the close of the year 1811, an intensified arming and concentrating of the forces of Western Europe began. And in 1812, these forces, millions of men, reckoning those transporting and feeding the army, moved from the west eastwards to the Russian frontier, toward which, since 1811, Russian forces had been similarly drawn. On the 12th of June, 1812, the forces of Western Europe crossed the Russian frontier and war began. That is, an event took place opposed to human reason and to human nature. Millions of men perpetrated against one another such innumerable crimes, frauds, treacheries, thefts, forgeries, issues of false money, burglaries, incendiarisms, and murders, as in whole centuries are not recorded in the annals of all the law courts of the world, but which those who committed them did not at the time regard as being crimes. What produced this extraordinary occurrence? What were its causes? The historians tell us with naive assurance that its causes were the wrongs inflicted on the Duke of Oldenburg, the non-observance of the continental system, the ambition of Napoleon, the firmness of Alexander, the mistakes of the diplomatists, and so on. Consequently, it would only have been necessary for Metternich, Rumyantsev, or Talleyrand, between a levee and an evening party, to have taken proper pains and written a more adroit note,
or for Napoleon to have written to Alexander, "My respected brother, I consent to restore the duchy to the Duke of Oldenburg," and there would have been no war. We can understand that the matter seemed like that to contemporaries. It naturally seemed to Napoleon that the war was caused by England's intrigues, as in fact he said on the island of St. Helena. It naturally seemed to members of the English Parliament that the cause of the war was Napoleon's ambition, to the Duke of Oldenburg that the cause of the war was the violence done to him, to businessmen that the cause of the war was the continental system which was ruining Europe, to the generals and old soldiers that the chief reason for the war was the necessity of giving them employment, to the legitimists of that day that it was the need of re-establishing les bons principes, and to the diplomatists of that time that it all resulted from the fact that the alliance between Russia and Austria in 1809 had not been sufficiently well concealed from Napoleon and from the awkward wording of Memorandum No. 178. It is natural that these and a countless and infinite quantity of other reasons, the number depending on the endless diversity of points of view, presented themselves to the men of that day. But to us, to posterity, who view the thing that happened in all its magnitude and perceive its plain and terrible meaning, these causes seem insufficient. To us, it is incomprehensible that millions of Christian men killed and tortured each other either because Napoleon was ambitious or Alexander was firm or because England's policy was astute or the Duke of Oldenburg wronged. We cannot grasp what connection such circumstances have with the actual fact of slaughter and violence. Why, because the Duke was wronged, thousands of men from the other side of Europe killed and ruined the people of Smolensk and Moscow and were killed by them. To us, their descendants, who are not historians and are not carried away by the process of research, and can therefore regard the event with unclouded common sense, an incalculable number of causes present themselves. The deeper we delve in search of these causes, the more of them we find, and each separate cause, or whole series of causes, appears to us equally valid in itself and equally false by its insignificance compared to the magnitude of the events, and by its impotence, apart from the cooperation of all the other coincident causes, to occasion the event. To us, the wish or objection of this or that French corporal to serve a second term appears as much a cause as Napoleon's refusal to withdraw his troops beyond the Vistula and to restore the Duchy of Oldenburg. For had he not wished to serve, and had a second, a third, and a thousandth corporal and private also refused, there would have been so many less men in Napoleon's army, and the war could not have occurred. Had Napoleon not taken offense at the demand that he should withdraw beyond the Vistula, and not ordered his troops to advance, there would have been no war. But had all his sergeants objected to serving a second term, then also there could have been no war. Nor could there have been a war had there been no English intrigues and no Duke of Oldenburg, and had Alexander not felt insulted, and had there not been an autocratic government in Russia or a revolution in France and a subsequent dictatorship and empire or all the things that produced the French Revolution, and so on. Without each of these causes, nothing could have happened. So all these causes, myriads of causes, coincided to bring it about. And so there was no one cause for that occurrence, but it had to occur because it had to. Millions of men, renouncing their human feelings and reason, had to go from west to east to slay their fellows, just as some centuries previously hordes of men had come from the east to the west slaying their fellows. The actions of Napoleon and Alexander, on whose words the event seemed to hang, were as little voluntary as the actions of any soldier who was drawn into the campaign by lot or by conscription. This could not be otherwise. For in order that the will of Napoleon and Alexander, on whom the event seemed to depend, should be carried out, the concurrence of innumerable circumstances was needed, without any one of which the event could not have taken place. It was necessary that millions of men in whose hands lay the real power, the soldiers who fired or transported provisions and guns, should consent to carry out the will of these weak individuals.
and should have been induced to do so by an infinite number of diverse and complex causes. We are forced to fall back on fatalism as an explanation of irrational events. That is to say, events the reasonableness of which we do not understand. The more we try to explain such events in history reasonably, the more unreasonable and incomprehensible do they become to us. Each man lives for himself, using his freedom to attain his personal aims, and feels with his whole being that he can now do or abstain from doing this or that action. But as soon as he has done it, that action performed at a certain moment in time becomes irrevocable and belongs to history, in which it has not a free, but a predestined significance. There are two sides to the life of every man: his individual life, which is the more free, the more abstract its interests, and his elemental hive life, in which he inevitably obeys laws laid down for him. Man lives consciously for himself, but is an unconscious instrument in the attainment of the historic, universal aims of humanity. A deed done is irrevocable, and its result, coinciding in time with the actions of millions of other men, assumes an historic significance. The higher a man stands on the social ladder, the more people he is connected with, and the more power he has over others, the more evident is the predestination and inevitability of his every action. The king's heart is in the hands of the Lord. A king is history's slave. History, that is, the unconscious general hive life of mankind, uses every moment of the life of kings as a tool for its own purposes. Though Napoleon at that time, in 1812, was more convinced than ever that it depended on him, verser ou ne pas verser le sang de ses peuples, to shed or not to shed the blood of his peoples, as Alexander expressed it in the last letter he wrote him, he had never been so much in the grip of inevitable laws which compelled him, while thinking that he was acting on his own volition, to perform for the hive life, that is to say, for history, whatever had to be performed. The people of the West moved eastwards to slay their fellow men, and by the law of coincidence, thousands of minute causes fitted in and coordinated to produce that movement and war. Reproaches for the non-observance of the continental system, the Duke of Oldenburg's wrongs, the movement of troops in Prussia, undertaken as it seemed to Napoleon only for the purpose of securing an armed peace, the French Emperor's love and habit of war coinciding with his people's inclinations, allurement by the grandeur of the preparations, and the expenditure on those preparations, and the need of obtaining advantages to compensate for that expenditure, the intoxicating honors he received in Dresden, the diplomatic negotiations, which in the opinion of contemporaries were carried on with a sincere desire to attain peace, but which only wounded the self-love of both sides, and millions of other causes that adapted themselves to the event that was happening or coincided with it. When an apple has ripened and falls, why does it fall? Because of its attraction to the earth? Because its stalk withers? Because it is dried by the sun? Because it grows heavier? Because the wind shakes it? Or because the boy standing below wants to eat it? Nothing is the cause. All this is only the coincidence of conditions in which all vital, organic, and elemental events occur. And the botanist who finds that the apple falls because the cellular tissue decays and so forth is equally right with the child who stands under the tree and says the apple fell because he wanted to eat it and prayed for it. Equally right or wrong is he who says that Napoleon went to Moscow because he wanted to, and perished because Alexander desired his destruction, and he who says that an undermined hill weighing a million tons fell because the last navvy struck it for the last time with his mattock. In historic events, the so-called great men
are labels giving names to events, and like labels, they have but the smallest connection with the event itself. Every act of theirs, which appears to them an act of their own will, is in an historical sense involuntary, and is related to the whole course of history and predestined from eternity. Chapter 2. Napoleon crosses the Niemen and sees Polish Uhlans drowned swimming the Vilia. On the 29th of May, Napoleon left Dresden, where he had spent 3 weeks surrounded by a court that included princes, dukes, kings, and even an emperor. Before leaving, Napoleon showed favor to the emperor, kings, and princes who had deserved it, reprimanded the kings and princes with whom he was dissatisfied, presented pearls and diamonds of his own, that is, which he had taken from other kings, to the Empress of Austria, and having, as his historian tells us, tenderly embraced the Empress Marie-Louise, who regarded him as her husband, though he had left another wife in Paris, left her grieved by the parting, which she seemed hardly able to bear. Though the diplomatists still firmly believed in the possibility of peace, and worked zealously to that end, and though the Emperor Napoleon himself wrote a letter to Alexander calling him Monsieur mon frère, my brother, and sincerely assured him that he did not want war and would always love and honor him, yet he set off to join his army, and at every station gave fresh orders to accelerate the movement of his troops from west to east. He went in a traveling coach with 6 horses, surrounded by pages, aides-de-camp, and an escort, along the road to Posen, Thorn, Danzig, and Königsberg. At each of these towns, thousands of people met him with excitement and enthusiasm. The army was moving from west to east, and relays of 6 horses carried him in the same direction. On the 10th of June, coming up with the army, he spent the night in apartments prepared for him on the estate of a Polish count in the Wilkawiski forest. Next day, overtaking the army, he went in a carriage to the Niemen, and changing into a Polish uniform, he drove to the riverbank in order to select a place for the crossing.